Morning. Morning. Say, you guys who are way back there, you can come in this room if you want. I'm talking about, or you can just come sit so you can see me if you don't want to come in this room. But if you'd rather not see me, that's okay. I'm just giving them a chance to make up their minds. Oh, now they can see me. Hi. Okay, so this morning I'm going to continue with the theme I was talking about last week. And I'll just quickly summarize what I was talking about last week, which is kind of a developmental psychology of Zen practice. A developmental phases of Zen practice based on these poems that I read last week. And so it starts with Zen practice, with making a commitment to Zen practice. And then practicing in difficulty is always part of it. And practicing in difficulty is part of it because if the practice just goes well, if the meditation just goes well, that's fine for a while. But the self-congratulation that comes from that just actually hardens ego. And our goal here is to just crack open ego. We don't want to destroy ego. We just want to crack it open and have a little light in there. A little light. Just a little bit. If there's a little bit of light, if there's a little crack, then all of a sudden ego is not separate from the rest of the universe, just with a little crack. So the first step then is practice, Zen practice, meditation practice, in difficulty. And then the second one is concentration or one-pointedness or samadhi. There's at some point we experience that, and then that leads to an opening, whether it's a big opening or a little opening, a realization, a sense of spaciousness, something. So that's the realization part. And then the third part, the last part, the fourth part, because we have practice, we have concentration, we have opening, and then personalization. We personalize it. What's the point of sitting on a cushion at all if we don't personalize, if we don't take into the world using our unique skills and express our heart and our feelings in a way that manifests that sense of openness and joy that comes when ego cracks open, even if it's just a little. So the poems I talked about last time, I'm not going to talk about them today, but they show this developmental process. The first one by Dogen: without bitterest cold that penetrates to the very bone, how can plum blossoms send forth their fragrance throughout the universe? And the second one by Basho, 400 years later: in plum blossom scent, pop, the sun appears, mountain path. So do you see the four there? And in plum blossom scent, we imagine Basho walking on a spring day when he's just immersed in the aroma of the plum blossoms, but it's totally foggy. And he's just doing his zazen walking. He's just in that scent, and there's nothing else there. And then all of a sudden the sun comes up. Pop! And then there's a mountain path. Then there's something to do. Something, some way of expressing what we feel. So this is a little bit like the Eightfold Path in Buddhism, but also a little different, because in Zen we emphasize the sitting, the zazen, which is the last three steps in the Eightfold Path. The effort, the mindfulness, the meditation. We start with that. if we started with all the other stuff, I mean, Buddhism is taught, usually people become monks historically when they're about 9-10 years old. So they really need to work on understanding intellectually what the Buddhist teaching is, and then work on just developing some basic habits of speech, action, and action, which aren't too offensive to people, because these are young adolescents. Young adolescents offend by their very nature. At least they offend folks like me, maybe not you guys. They're born to offend, right? Too bad we have to outgrow that. I used to get away with a lot of stuff. Especially guys got away with stuff. I'm afraid my sisters didn't get away with the stuff I did. So in Zen, though, we just do the sitting. We say that the practice of the sitting, the practice of the meditation, is what we do first. And then we can begin to say, oh, some people have written about what happens when you meditate. Well, that's cool. And that can be encouraging. Oh, yes, we should behave ethically and morally. That's cool. But the sitting itself has a transformative possibility for us, so that the understanding that comes, we don't even have to know, read the books ahead of time. We just feel it. And then the behavior, ideally, comes from that open heart and that still mind. So, but this is a commitment, right? Commitment to do this. And it's a commitment to the unknown. When I started sitting, I had no introduction. Suzuki Roshi told me, I said, what book should I read? He said, well, why would you read a book? And I said, well, can't you give me some instruction? He said, no, just come here, sit with me. And then, well, you guys know this. I've talked about this before. How should I sit? No. Just come sit. How should I keep my mind? No. Just come sit with me. But shouldn't I do something with my mind? No. Just come sit. How often? Oh, every morning and every night. Every morning and every night. And there's no how? That's the way those guys taught it. Katagiri Roshi taught it that way too. But Suzuki Roshi was worse. If Katagiri Roshi at least gave us books to read. So, we feel insecure when we do this sometimes. And Helen Keller says, security is mostly a superstition. It doesn't exist in nature, nor do the children of humans as a whole experience it. Avoiding difficulty is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. So this process of committing yourself to meditation is a daring adventure. It may seem like it's boring, it may seem like it's tedious, it may seem like it's painful, but if you really do, it's a daring adventure because you don't have any props. You're just coming back to doing it. Just coming back to doing it and doing it and doing it until you're not doing it. It's just doing itself. It's always been doing itself anyway. But we're always trying to adjust it, to improve it. It's human nature. So when I started practice, I first read a book. I just found a book, and the last chapter was a story by Arthur Koestler. And Arthur Koestler had been in the Spanish Civil War, and he was imprisoned, and he was put in solitary confinement. And in solitary confinement, he had no books to read. He had no techniques to use. He had nothing. The only thing he had for his background chanting was guns going off in the background, because they were shooting other, they were taking people out and shooting them. So he was in solitary confinement in his cell. He didn't know he was in his zazen cell. But it was you don't think your cell is good, but when you do your cell, it's wonderful. You may hate it, but he just stayed in his cell. He didn't have any choice. In Sesshin, you can run away, from Zazen, you can run away. I'm only going to sit for 5 minutes today. Maybe tomorrow I'll sit for 8 minutes, 80 minutes. But he was totally in his cell, just like Katagiri Roshi was in his cell with his teacher. He wanted to get away, but he made his commitment just to sit with his stupid teacher day after day, morning and night. Morning and night. Morning and night. And so, Arthur Koestler, just in his cell, just sitting, looking at the wall, and then all of a sudden something happened. He began to see the wall the way he'd never seen anything before. And all of a sudden, incredible stillness penetrated his psyche, all through him, all through him. And he experienced nothing, everything, no I, no I. Wonder and joy. And he didn't know anything about it. He had read no books. You don't need to know anything about it. It's better that you don't know anything about it. Oops, if I say that, no one will come to my classes. What will I do? I'll be all by myself. Well, we're all by ourselves anyway. We are all by ourselves. I notice how when we sit here together, especially in retreats, people want to communicate with each other. They have such a hard time just staying in their cell. But you have to stay in your cell if you want to let go of little tiny chattering self. You have to completely stay in your cell. Completely. That's Zen practice. Wherever you are, that's Zen practice. So, here at Zen Center, we have our meditation, and our meditation, and our meditation. And there are many, many different ways that we can quiet ourselves, because this is all about quieting ourselves in our cell, so that when we're completely quiet, small self just stops. It just stops. It just stops. It doesn't have anything to complain about anymore. Can you imagine not having anything to complain about anymore? Nothing to compare anymore? Me to you, her to him. Who's getting more of my time? Who's getting more of his time? Who's better? Can you imagine that? It's good for you to imagine it. Don't imagine it too much. Just imagine it enough to get your butt on the cushion. That's how much you should imagine it. But not anymore. But then you get your butt on the cushion, you spend all your time just imagining it. A little bit. A little bit. So how you do it is, for me, it doesn't matter whether you, how you do your meditation, whether you watch your breathing, count your breathing, do shikantaza, which I won't explain. I can't explain anyway. Repeat some gata or mantra. You know what Alfred Lord Tennyson did? You know what his meditation was? Anybody know? He repeated his name over and over and over again. That sounds kind of egocentric. He had a great awakening by repeating his name over and over and over again. He just did it. He didn't know. Of course, didn't last, but... Sounds kind of self-centered, maybe, but it's just a word. I don't know if he repeated Alfred, 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 or Tennyson, 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 over and over again. To quiet the mind. The mind is intrinsically quiet. It's intrinsically totally still, which was what Arthur Koestler discovered. Then after that, he didn't even care if they were going to shoot him or not, because he had discovered life which is beyond life and death. But he didn't have a practice. So this faded into a memory for him. For a while, for several days, it would come back. But by the time he was released from prison, it was just a memory. He didn't have a practice. And then he went to Japan and he got all bummed out by Japanese Zen. He wrote a book called The Lotus and the Robot, which really criticized Japanese Zen. I don't think he must have not found a good teacher. So, as we quiet ourselves down in this practice, we see the veils, the varanas, V-A-R-A-N-A-S, the veils that keep ego solid, that keep it protected, that protect ego. And so there are the bodily veils, the bodily varanas. And one of the bodily varanas is just contraction in the body, just holding in the body. Why do we hold? Why do we contract so much in the body? Well, to protect ourselves, to protect ego, which has been hurt by people in the past. So that's the first veil. And here's a story about a Zen teacher who talks about his experiences with the veils. Well, this is a Zen teacher who remembers when he was a student. At first, it was my knees that hurt, and I blamed it all on the meditation. But then I felt my neck and shoulders become hot, my back more painful in places it always felt tight. The tension in my body continued to grow. At times it was even hard to breathe deeply. Memories and old pains were surfacing now. It was so unpleasant, I tried to push it away. I even tried to meditate by lying down on the softest pad I could find. Well, I guess he wasn't in one of our retreats. Hoping the pain would go away. But to my surprise, even lying down, as soon as I really paid attention, all the tension was right there again, waiting for me. I fought with my body a long time, years. Only when I finally learned to let even the deepest pain be okay and hold it with kindness did it begin to release. Now it comes and goes. What a blessing it was to finally accept my body. So that's one of the bodily veils. The second bodily veil is the veil that comes from wanting to move, wanting to be someplace, feeling like you shouldn't be sitting here. You've got things to do. You've got things to accomplish. You're wasting your time. This isn't working anyway. And so the need to perpetually move, to perpetually be something, be someone, get something. Jesus, it's Christmas season. How many presents didn't I buy today? And it's already the 17th. And the stores are going to be so full. I should get out there immediately instead of sitting here on my butt. Or I won't show up. I'll show up at Christmas with nothing. Well, that's good. Emptiness. Nothing. Nothing. All the better. All the better. But that's not so much our culture, is it? And we want to get along with our family to a degree. I bought my one present yesterday. I bought my one present for my grandson. I won't get into that. So the bodily veils, and then the veils over the heart, the varanas over the heart, the varanas that conceal the heart. These come up in our sitting. We see these in our sitting, and we get discouraged. But they're there already, those veils. They're there already. They're with us all the time. In our sitting, we don't have anything but the veils to see. So the veils over the heart. There are two main types of veils. One is kind of that. The anger veil, anger in all of its manifestations. It's hurts. It's insults. Somebody said once, so this was Rinpoche said once, that Zen practice is nothing but enduring one insult after another. Boy, you want to stick around and do this with me for a while? We'll have a good time. But in a way, the sitting process, you're insulted. You're insulted when you see how you freeze up, how you contract. And in your life, too, you begin to see how you do that. And the more you see that, the more there's a potential to see that it's just a veil. And it can drop away. And underneath the anger veil, as we were talking about this morning, is the loneliness veil. The loneliness veil. The grief veil. The sadness veil. The fear veil. Anger is usually covering up that veil. It does a good job of covering up that veil. It's energetic, got lots of color, lots of force. But if you really still that veil of anger, it parts, and then you're ready for the loneliness veil. The loneliness veil. But if you stay with that, sooner or later it parts, and then your heart is nice and soft. Nice and open, and you don't even try to open it. It's just soft. Everything is soft. But this doesn't just happen. This happens through practice in difficulty. Through practice in difficulty. And you don't need to cultivate any difficulty. Don't cultivate any difficulty. You'll get one. Mm-hmm. In Rinzai Zen, they're always cultivating a difficulty. We think, geez, why would they do that to themselves? We get it already. It's already here. And then the third type of veil, the bodily veil, the heart veil, and of course the mind veil. And I talk so much about that. Zen teachers talk so much about that. All of the chatter, all of the habits, all of the worries, holiday season, wanting to be with the family, not wanting to be with the family, wanting to be with this member, not that member. How can I communicate with him in a way that I can feel connected to him but don't have to spend too much time with him? How are we going to be there and be still when there's so much chaos around the season, the holiday season, so many people with so much expectation about having a good time and really being together, and that expectation then getting in the way of just being? All that stuff. And these veils make up the body of fear. In Buddhism, they make up the body of fear. The veils over the heart, veils over the body, and the veils over the mind. They make up the body of fear. And so Zen practice is about seeing that, those veils, about seeing them and not ripping them off, but just seeing that they're actually transparent, if you look at them, that they're actually just completely transparent. They're just the lightest gossamer veils that you could imagine. Though they don't seem so at first. And then there's a change of the body of fear into a body of maybe wisdom, but not some fancy kind of wisdom, just sort of being alive and being here and being with others without any veil at all. And then more veils come in. But then you know they're just veils, so it's not something you get all wrapped up about, you get all concerned about. So that's our practice. That's our practice. And it can be very discouraging. And it can be very encouraging. Sometimes, wow, I really heard what Katagiri Roshi said when I read that book. It just moved me and I felt so still. I heard what so-and-so said, or I felt when I looked at the wall, that some great peace, and just the spaciousness of the patterns in the wall, although there's nothing there. And then other times, very discouraged. And that's just the way it goes. That's the way it goes. So I haven't told this story in a while, but there was a point when I started out very encouraged after I read that first book by Arthur Koestler. I thought, wow! That's for me. I don't want to do anything else. That's all I want to do, is do that practice in a cell. So I found out that I could do it by working with a Zen teacher. Somebody said, well, what he's talking about is what they do in Zen, only they just do that on purpose. They don't do it by accident. So as you guys know, then I went to the city where I was from and found the Zen center in the phone book. Went and met my teacher. Became my teacher. But then I got discouraged, and I really felt like quitting. And we all reach times like this if we're serious about paying attention to these veils and serious about parting these veils. First, we have to put up with them a lot. We have to see them a lot. We have to know them pretty intimately for them to drop away. And it's discouraging. And for me, in those days, especially when my I had many problems with my body, with just pains, much more than I do now. I have other problems now, but problems with pains, big pains. I think I had never sat up straight. I'd always just sat on my neck for high school and junior high school and even college, sitting on my neck in the back of the room and drinking a lot, etc. But after I had really cleaned up my act and been practicing for a long time, it just didn't seem like I was making much progress. I'd have these little cracks of opening and then go back to my just general melee. And then there were other people who seemed to be getting it. We always think other people are getting it, don't we? And there were these two guys who really looked like they got it. They sat so still, whereas I was wiggling. They knew the ceremony so well. They did it with such fluidity, where I was just wobbling. And that was very discouraging. Very discouraging. And so then I had a dream, which I've talked about before here. And it was a dream when I was just on the verge of quitting. I was just on the verge of quitting. In my dream, these two guys were in the room about this size. These two guys were the best meditators. They were the best ones. And I could tell Suzuki Roshi thought they were the best too. He didn't pay that much attention to me. But to them, them. And of course that hurt me. That hurt me. I felt hurt. I thought he was supposed to be there for all beings. What about me? Aren't I a being too? You ever experience this kind of thing? A lot of competition in the Zen centers. Everybody wants to be acknowledged. Everybody wants to be liked and get time with the teacher. But that's true. It's a whole human society is like that. Why should a Zen center be any different than the human society? Just a bunch of humans hanging out together, trying to get our needs met. So, in my dream, these two guys took up the whole room, and their heads were at the ceiling, and they were sitting in perfect full lotus. And one of them actually did sit in perfect full lotus, and he still does. I'm still kind of mad about that. But underneath that anger, and then underneath... What an adventure! What an adventure this is! Taking up the whole room. I thought, oh, my dream. Well, then, remember me talking about this dream before? Then this little kind of sprite comes into the room. It's a little, something is going along the room at the bottom, and it's like going like this, turning somersaults. And it's my teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And he was like 4'10", right? He was. So these guys are, they're 7 feet tall, 9 feet tall, 11 feet tall. They're getting bigger all the time, right? As I'm feeling more insignificant, more like this isn't for me. I chose the wrong thing. I should have just gone to Spain, done something with Arthur Koestler, whatever. We do this kind of thing all the time, right? Most of us do. But there he was. There was Suzuki, my teacher, and he was turning somersaults all around him. And they couldn't see him because they were so big. And he was so tiny. They couldn't see him. And he was smiling. And he was calling me to come in. Come in and join him. And I saw there was plenty of room for me to come in. There was plenty of room for me to join him, to turn somersaults with him, and those big people wouldn't see. It didn't matter. And then I woke up. Then I didn't quit. Then I didn't quit. So we need encouragement. And sometimes we may get a dream. Sometimes we just may get a little pat on the head, or somebody may say something that will help us realize that this is life. This is not, this practice and this life aren't very different. So we say we want to get away from this practice. It means we want to get away from our life. But this is what we've got, our life, our karma. So through practice, the body just eases up. It just eases up. The heart just softens. And the old stories just fall away. You may not believe it, but they do. They just fall away. There's fall, there's autumn, and they fall away. No, spring will come. Spring will come, and there'll be new stories. Oh, that's fine. We're human beings, love to tell stories. That's how we perpetuate our species, telling stories. We tell some kind of nasty ones and some nice ones. Katagiri Roshi said, when people see me today, they don't see the years I spent just doing zazen and being with my teacher. The years. St. John of the Cross said, to awaken to the great heart of Jesus, you must be willing to tread for a long time as a blind man in the darkness. You must be willing to tread for a long time as a blind man in the darkness. And when you're treading as a blind man in the darkness, it doesn't seem like an adventure anymore. It doesn't seem like an adventure. But it is. It is. That's just your ego wanting to get something out of it. But your ego has to stop. Completely stop. And it will. It will. It will. So practice leads to realization. As Arthur Koestler found out. And realization can be big, it can be little, it can be dramatic, it can be not much anything at all. It doesn't really matter. But here's a couple of Zen teachers. And this is a Buddhist teacher, American Buddhist teacher in India, talking about experience of cracking open he had. He's at his temple. He's been sitting in a long retreat in India where there are a lot of dogs. Dogs all over the place. If you've ever been to India, dogs and people. I when I was in India, I thought, God, how could Buddha put up with this? There's oh, that's what I thought. There's no space ever to be by yourself. No space. You can't even go. I wanted to go for walks, and geez, I could go for a walk. There are 100,000 people jostling you, and dogs, and everything, rickshaws, and pollution. probably wasn't quite that bad in Buddhist time. The people are really warm. Anyway, that's another subject. I won't go into that. Anyway, he's in India, on a long retreat, and he's saying, "This is what he says." People drop off unwanted dogs for the temple to care for. And at this retreat, there was a new litter of puppies, several very sick. I sat for days with one whimpering puppy after another. I was completely cut open by this. Many dogs would come and go. That day, though, I saw that the underlying truth of life doesn't change, although it manifests in those changing bodies. I kept meditating with the puppies and the puppy shit, and then went back into the hall. I became very still. Thoughts and intentions would arise and dissolve in an instant, but there would be no impulse to follow them. And then some deeper letting go happened, like a huge bursting of all perception into space, into emptiness. Suddenly there was no self, nothing to do or solve. That was all just foolishness. I was lifted off my cushion with a smile 6 feet wide, and in the emptiness joy arose, a river with no edges, a dance of emptiness, a confirmation of freedom where life is no problem. Self is no problem. Even sick dogs are no problem. And here's a woman teacher, woman Buddhist teacher, who was during a walking meditation in the garden near the temple that I first felt emptiness. I can remember the exact spot. I lifted my foot and put it down on the earth, felt all the sensations of moving, and knew there was no one to whom it happened. No self at all. The thought came, it's an empty process. And this thought was as empty as the step. So those are two examples of the cracking open that can occur. Two descriptions of it that's referred to as stream entry in Buddhism. And it's cracking open the bottom, the body of fear. And Su Yun, Chinese teacher, said at 120 years old, there are many minor satoris before a major satori, and many major satoris on the path of genuine awakening. On the other hand, sometimes there are no special experiences at all. It just happens, and you don't even notice it. It just happens. I was at a retreat with Shahaku Okamura once a few years ago, and there were a bunch of teachers there, and a couple of people were talking about experience of Kensho, of opening, and Shahaku said, "Oh, I never had one of those." I never had one of those. Well, he's a very deep, wise teacher. So he never had a special experience. Sometimes ego cracks open and you don't know. You don't need to know. It doesn't need to be any fireworks. It doesn't need to be any drama. It's just life. Just life. And then out of this practice, we personalize, as I was saying last time. We don't have to have our practice be very advanced to personalize. One sitting is all that's necessary to have a little calmness, which then you want to carry with you into the world in some personal way. And there's so many different ways of personalizing. So many different ways. And we have these Chinese Zen masters who had their special way, like Gute had his one finger Zen. That was his personalization. One finger, one finger, one finger. Everybody asked him, he said one finger. That was his. And we have Suzuki Roshi. What was his way? His way was working with rocks and hippies. I don't know why. He didn't know he was going to have to work with hippies, but he started working with rocks when he was young, and I think it helped him personalize with hippies. He had enough years of rock practice that when he got to San Francisco, he thought, oh, here are a bunch of more of them. All this. That was his personalization. So we all have our personalization. And we don't need to do someone else's. We do ours. We discover what it is. How we're going to reach out. How we're going to express a softer heart and our stiller mind. And don't wait until you're perfect to do that. Do that now. Do that now. 1 minute of sitting and 1 minute of expression. You can express yourself just as you are. Just as you are. And then the veils are kind of irrelevant. They come and go, but they're kind of irrelevant. So Wei Ning said, one enlightened thought and one is a Buddha. And one foolish thought and one is again an ordinary person. So, what's the difference? What's the difference? We're Buddhas, we're ordinary people. Sometimes we're caught by the veils, sometimes we're free of veils, sometimes we're kind, sometimes we're not so kind. But in that very act of seeing our lack of kindness, there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity. So Milarepa, long after his enlightenment. After his enlightenment, he stayed in it. You know Milarepa, the Tibetan saint, Milarepa? And he practiced by himself in his own cell, which is his own cave, and then he had a great enlightenment. Then he stayed in his cave and hung out, and just stayed in the area there for a long time. Then long after, he decided to go outside his cave, and he came back, and his cave was full of spirits. Full of spirits. Not nice spirits, evil spirits, nasty spirits. So he was, there they were, taking up his space in his beautiful cave, where he had his candles and his Buddha statue. where he had had all of his blissful experiences, and now it was filled up with spirits. So he just walked in and he said to them, "You non-human demons assembled here are obstacles. Drink this nectar of friendliness and compassion and be gone." See, he learned how to do this. But it worked for only the first three demons. The first three demons who were performing magic went away. Realizing that the remaining demons were magical obstacles, he sang this song of confidence. "It is wonderful that you demons came today. You must come again tomorrow. From time to time we should chat." With this, three more demons vanished like a rainbow. The remaining demons performed an imposing dance, and Milarepa thought, "This one is vicious and powerful." So he sang another song. "A demon like you does not intimidate me." He was shaking while he sang this. You know, sometimes we'll be shaking. We'll be shaking. But that means we're alive. And if we're sincere and we keep our heart open and don't just get carried away by all our thinking, we can do it. We can all do it. "A demon like you does not intimidate me. Shake, shake, shake." "If a demon like you could intimidate me, the arising of the mind of compassion would be of little meaning. Demon, if you were to stay longer, that would be fine with me. Shake, shake, shake. If you have friends, bring them along. We will talk out our differences." And then he turns to Buddha. "Lord Vajradhara Buddha, grant your blessing so that this lowly one may have complete compassion." And then Milarepa placed himself in the mouth of the demon, but the demon couldn't eat him and so vanished. That's the story about Milarepa. So, to believe in a spiritual life in which the sun is always at midday is a stupid belief, you guys. It's a stupid belief. The sun, the moon, the earth, the stars, we don't know. We don't know. We just don't know. We have, all we can do is just be here. Seeing the veils, and letting go of the veils. So here's another Zen teacher. This guy, Jack Kornfield, compiled all of these, I don't know, he must have gone out and he interviewed all these Buddhist teachers, all these Zen teachers. You guys seen this book before? And then he wrote about them. Pardon? After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. After 30 years of sitting, it seems like even 50 years of practice will be only a short while. Now I take the long view over lifetimes. My commitment is simple. It is a dedication to the highest aspiration of enlightenment. Time is not a question. It's important that we teach the possibility of becoming utterly free, and we let every simple act every day be illuminated by this possibility, by this truth. So, that's it. That's what we've got as human beings. And we can choose to engage in this adventure, or we can choose to withdraw from this adventure. And when we withdraw, we get very hard. We may protect ourselves, but we only protect ourselves so much. Because the more we get hard, and the more we get fear-based and fear-driven, the more separate we feel, the more isolated we feel, the more uptight we feel, and the more alone we feel, really alone. So, we have a choice in this holiday season, in any season. And probably I could end with a quote from Dogen Zenji, in which he said toward the end of his life, "My life has been one mistake after another." My life has been one mistake after another. I don't know if he was grinning when he said that or not, but it makes me grin. So So on that cheery note, questions? Comments? Kathleen? Thank you. Thank you for an anatomical elaboration. Anybody else? Yeah.
What is a satori, and what's the difference between a major and a minor satori? Oh.
Sorry I brought it up. Well, satori means awakening in Japanese. It means awakening. And it means a minor satori would be just a little cracking open of ego, in which for a moment the mind stops and what you see is what you are. What you see is what you are. Just even if it only lasts that long, that's a minor satori. Do you understand what I mean? Just for a moment, your mind is so still that what you look at is what you are. And then a major satori is that all your fictional stealth stuff just goes. Gone, 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 gone. All the stories just go, 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 go. Completely. Completely. And then you feel connected to everything. But it's not something you read about. You don't know anything about reading or writing. You just feel the heart of the universe is your own heart. But it doesn't even seem like a heart. Just beating wonderfully. Wonderfully. But don't pay too much attention to that. I shouldn't talk so much about this. Both of my teachers talk less about this than me. They're better teachers than me. Anything else?